one goal of this war is to get back to where we were before we started this war. Go ahead.
For the benefit of the American people. And it really is twofold. It's ensuring that the Gulf countries continue to send oil and gas to the world economy so that we have energy price stability. That's obviously important for the American people. I know that oil is down today, and it's way down from the highs in the early days of the conflict. That's goal number one, keep oil and gas cheap for Americans all over our country. And then obviously goal number two is ensure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon. I feel confident we're accomplishing both of those goals, but it's inherently an unpredictable thing because the Iranians themselves are unpredictable, and they sometimes don't honor the commitments they've made to us.
Fascinating, fascinating. So the people that we attacked are completely unpredictable. We had no idea they would respond in this way. It was also unpredictable that we would exhaust all of our weapons on Iran and nothing would change there, despite the fact that on this very show, and I'm sure in a million other places, we had experts on months, years, I mean, throughout any conversations we've had with Iran, we say you cannot decapitate Iran like you could some Latin American country or, frankly, other countries in the Middle East because the Iranian guard is so decentralized. And apparently now the hardliners in Iran have given the Iranian guard even more control of the military. But again, it's decentralized. So it's completely unpredictable that they would do this. And our goal number one is to make sure that we get back to where we were months ago when we started this conflict. And then, you know, number two is the fake excuse of why we had this war.
Remember when we got in this war because of the people of Iran deserve freedom?
The who? We're going to punish them now for their lack of freedom. Apparently Donald Trump was listening last night because as he said, you know, when he said in his comment, like, I don't care about the midterms. I don't care about any of it. I have no timeline. He's saying this because he thinks he's being clever. And he's going to fool the Iranians into thinking like, wow, this guy can wait us out.
Like when he said the USS Lincoln people haven't been there long enough.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like he, and his whole theory of the case is if I pretend that I'm completely not, I just don't care, then Iran will cave. And so here's Donald Trump, obviously very angry that J.D. Vance has given away the store on Fox News by telling everybody that, hey, we don't really care about the nuclear thing. I mean, it's number two, but here it is. Take that down, because I just want to say apologies to those listeners of ours who pay $100,000 to see Trump's truths in advance. You've probably already seen this.
Yeah, I put 50G down on the number one goal shifting to not having a nuke.
Well, that's on Kalshi. You make those bets. But this is just...
But I had got the info.
This is, yeah, just to get the inside track so you can invest properly. Donald Trump truthed out this morning. The number one goal is, and you should read that as, the number one goal, JD, is, and always will be, JD, that Iran cannot have, JD. He just puts in commas when he wants to make it clear he's talking to. In any way, comma, shape, comma, or form, comma, a nuclear weapon. Thank you for your attention to this matter, President Donald J. Trump.
JD stands for giant douche.
Yes.
Truth that out.
You just gave away the store. I had them on their knees. I had Iran on their knees and you gave it away. It's the Vandals and JD Vance who are ruining everything. In a moment, we're going to have Daniel Bessner on. Historian, journalist, associate professor of American foreign policy on his book, Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century. And also the co-host of American Prestige, right?
Yep.
And well, he wanted me to plug his new Substack, which is also Imperialist Realism.
Oh, okay. And his Substack, Imperialist Realism. Ooh,
branding.
Talk about real politique. Do my Substack and not my podcast. We'll be with him in just a moment, and then Elijah Manley. But first, a word from our sponsors. We have two of them today. Shouldn't have read this before the show. Should just done it blind. Because as soon as I read the words wild grain, I immediately started thinking chocolate chip cookies. And now I'm thinking, as I try not to think of chocolate chip cookies, I'm thinking of croissants and pumpkin biscuits. I didn't get any wild grain in the past, 2 months, essentially, because I was away for working, and then I didn't have Saul, and I want to share it with him, but this is the best subscription food you can get. Wild Grain delivers sourdough breads, seasonal pastries, and French butter right to your door, all made by small independent bakeries. Everything bakes straight from frozen in 25 minutes or less. So you can enjoy freshly baked favorites whenever you want them. I am telling you, you have never smelled something so good than fresh bread or fresh croissant baking in your oven. And it's so easy. And unlike grocery store options, Wild Grain uses simple, recognizable ingredients, slow fermentation process, which is often easier to digest. You can customize your box. You get the classic or the gluten-free, or the vegan, or the protein options. Wild Grain, I mean, the quality of these breads are fantastic. If you had told me, if I hadn't tried it myself, I would have never believed that it could be so, just bake from scratch tasting. The dough is frozen. Brian's stomach.
Brian's moaning.
I hate these ad reads.
The sourdough bread. Brian got a loaf of that sourdough bread and then didn't stop talking about it for 6 weeks. And you could do all this within 25 minutes or less. Literally, you take it out of the freezer. You put it on the parchment paper on the pan. I don't know if you need the parchment paper. That's what I use. And no matter what it is, cookies, croissant, loaves of bread, 25 minutes or less. If you're looking for an easy way to enjoy bakery quality bread at home, I would definitely recommend giving Wild Grain a try. Wild Grain has more than 40,000 five-star reviews, was named USA's Today's Best Food Subscription Box 3 years in a row. They have an award-winning croissants. Visit wildgrain.com/majority. Get $30 off your first box plus free croissant for life. That's wildgrain.com/majority. $30 off your first box and free croissants for life. Use promo code MAJORITY at checkout. We'll put the information in the podcast and YouTube description. Also, sponsoring the program today, OneSkin. Emma's been using OneSkin, and Brian, your girlfriend, we don't name her, do we?
No.
Has been using it. Apparently, a lot of skincare products make big promises but can't deliver. OneSkin's different. And that's why Emma and Brian's girlfriend, we'll call her
supermodel. She's busy in the Caribbean right now at a photo shoot.
But she loves one. They never set out to become a skincare company. They were founded by four PhD longevity scientists. They focused on one thing, skin aging. Quick fixes or marketing trends were never the point. They tested best-selling anti-aging products on the market and found the same hard truth over and over. None of them were working on the actual cause of aging. They were all just working on the surface signs of aging, which apparently doesn't work out at all. After years of research and testing over 900 novel peptides, they developed OS1, their proprietary peptide, proven to address a leading driver of visible skin aging. It's the foundation of every product they make, so over time you'll see smoother skin, more even tone and radiance, and visibly fewer lines. Skin that both looks and acts younger. What does your girlfriend say about this stuff?
she gets frustrated. She runs out of it. Like, we have like a 2-week gap before we get the new mill. And she's like, "You're gonna have to start buying this for me." She really likes it. I don't know. I have.
You guys don't talk about skincare regimen at home?
She might. I don't know if I hear it.
Emma,
you know, I don't know if I like take it in.
You better stop digging yourself a hole.
Sweating.
Emma loves it though. And OneSkin's results are backed by 4 peer-reviewed clinical studies, and they've been recognized by Bloomberg and Fast Company as a leader in skin longevity. I want to thank OneSkin for sponsoring today's episode. Born from over 10 years of longevity research, OneSkin is helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using the code MAJORITY at OneSkin.co/majority. That's 15% off OneSkin.co, code MAJORITY. After your purchase, they're going to ask you where you heard about them. Support the show. Tell them we sent you. And we'll put all the information in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Quick break. When we come back, Daniel Bessner on his book, The Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Viglin out today. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Daniel Bessner, historian, journalist, associate professor of American foreign policy at the University of Washington, with his new book, Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century, which has both been born out of and given birth to his Substack, Imperial Realism, by the same name, and of course, also a co-host of American Prestige. Danny, back on the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me, Sam. It's a pleasure to be back.
Let's start with Mark Fisher and capitalist realism, which is a concept that he developed, and you have sort of like extended or at least borrowed like sort of the dynamic in some way to explain the era we're in now. So give us a sense of that. And then I want to go to the era that preceded this one, and then we'll get to the era we're in now.
Well, yeah, no, let's do it. So Mark Fisher wrote kind of a blog post that became pretty popular, and it was published as a book called Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative? And so realism itself is a concept that has a deep history in philosophy and intellectual history, and sort of the notion of looking at the world as it is. But Fisher, building on the work of Frederick Jameson, a famous literary theorist and also friend of the pod, Slavoj Žižek, reappropriated that to talk about what it felt like to be living in a capitalist world in the 2000s and 2010s, effectively after the end of the Cold War, although I don't think he really periodized it. He was more of a literary theorist, wasn't a historian per se. And he argued, famous phrase, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And so I actually came to my own concept of imperialist realism from a bit of a circuitous route. I was tasked with reviewing a video game, the Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War video game. I'm sure people know Call of Duty is a very famous first-person shooter. And I imagine, like many lefties and liberals, I came into the game thinking that it would just be, you know, if not totally, but basically rah-rah U.S. empire, rah-rah U.S. foreign policy. But what I actually discovered was that it was much more ambivalent about U.S. foreign relations and the United States' role in the world. It essentially presented the protagonists of the game as, for lack of a better phrase, evil sociopaths, genuine psychopaths, sort of the bad guys in the John Milius film. And I started to think through, what did that mean, where you have this really profound criticism of American empire as being run effectively by sociopaths, but no vision within the game of there could be another world, this an alternative world is possible. And that just reminded me of Fisher. And basically from there, I started to develop this concept of imperialist realism in a much more historian's way than Fisher did, really trying to periodize it to a particular moment. And I've been talking for a while, and I could get into why, but that's basically the long and short of it.
No, get into the why. Sure. I mean, I think I just want people to sort of marinate in the idea of what that means to not be able to envision the end of capitalism before the end of the world. And, you know, we have a lot of like post-apocalyptic movie. Like, it's very easy to envision the end of the world. Yet it's very hard to envision the end of capitalism. And similarly speaking, our empire, it's very difficult to sort of like, and that constrains us in the way that we think about things. Obviously, if you don't even have a concept that it could be different, your starting point starts from a different place.
Absolutely. And if you want to think about it in pop culture terms, think about how many Walking Deads there are versus how many Star Treks. Star Trek is a genuine envision of an alternative post-capitalist future. And there were more than just one Star Trek throughout the history of pop culture. But now something like that seems almost unimaginable. And you could look at the Star Trek movies. They weren't really emphasizing the post-capitalism there, but that's almost a different story. So I link imperialist realism, this notion that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of the American empire, to two things. First, what I've called the end of mass politics. And what I mean by that is that you could actually trace, beginning from the 1940s onward, a conscious decision made by the American elite to essentially insulate U.S. foreign policymaking from the whims of the public and even Congress. And the famous quote or factoid there, rather, is the fact that Congress hasn't declared war since 1942. Obviously, the United States has fought many wars since then. And so that's one structuring condition, is that people feel oftentimes rightly when it comes to American foreign policy that they aren't able to shape policy decisions, and really the government doesn't listen to them. You can even look at it with the Iran war, which is unique in that it's, to my mind, to my understanding at least, the only American war that actually started off incredibly unpopular. Most American wars have a surge of popularity at the beginning, and then they become unpopular. The Iran war, no one wanted that. Didn't really matter. You could even look to the Iraq war, which before it occurred, there was the largest mass protest in history. Didn't matter because the elite is insulated from the public when it comes to foreign policy making.
Bush, yes, specifically said, I'm not going to listen to a focus group.
Correct.
In response to those protests.
Exactly. It's a perfect quote. So that's one condition, and then the other condition, maybe the more proximate condition, because the end of mass politics has been going on for almost a century, is the failure of the global war on terror. That it's difficult for us to remember now, but Sam, you'll remember and I'll remember because we're a bit older, is that people really, and Americans in particular, went into the global war on terror with actual hopes. The Cold War had ended. The United States was a world hegemon. The United States was actually going to make the world more democratic. But obviously, the many failures since then, the failure of Afghanistan, the failure of Iraq, the rise of ISIS, the failure of Libya, as I think given lie to the claim that the United States is able to use its admittedly awesome power in the service of the greater good. So I think those two structural factors have combined to create imperialist realism, but just very quickly, as I think defined by three things. First, cynicism about the use of American power. Second, the belief that even though the United States can't make the world a better place, the United States must therefore act in the world. And that is due to two things. One, the sheer reality of American power, and two, the Protestant heritage of this country, which has an evangelical tinge to it. And then finally,
You call that in the book missionism, is that right?
Missionism, correct. Missionism, apologies, correct. So, and then cynicism, missionism, and then the tension between cynicism and missionism, but leads to what I think is this notion of tragic guilt, that even though the United States can't make the world a better place, it must act, and therefore we feel guilty about it. And you saw this very much in the Biden administration vis-a-vis Gaza, and you saw it over the past 25 years vis-a-vis the war on terror generally with Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. So those are sort of the key features of this term, imperialist realism, which I explore in the book and on the Substack, both of which have the same name, imperialist realism.
Let's go back to what preceded imperial. Well, before we go back, like what is who is impacted and who is generating this? The imperial realism, because I imagine that the U.S. foreign policy impetus has not dramatically changed over the course of our entire history. It is somebody has a financial interest, some entity, whether it's, George Washington wants to get real estate in the what was then the Pacific Northwest. Somebody wants control of the bananas in Central America, or somebody has oil interests, or there is always that at the heart of what I seems like U.S. foreign policy. And then there's this sort of nougat that, surrounds it on some level. Is that what we're talking about? Are we in like the nougat here?
Partially. So I think as American foreign policy at sort of fundamental level being driven by two things. And the way that I put it, it's not only Marx, like you said, the economic, but it's also Engels, the focus on security. So I think the two primary drivers of most of human history are economic incentives, but also incentives for security. This is really an explanation for westward expansion, the expansion overseas and the seizure of colonies during the Spanish-American War, the domination of the Western Hemisphere, and then the United States going global after 1945. I think it's a combination of both economic interests and security interests. Now, what you and I might define as a genuine security interest differs from what, let's say, a Curtis LeMay might have defined as security interest, but it was a real driver. It wasn't just money, even though that's a key feature. But one thing that I do think it is important to understand is that the people who were building the American empire from 1776 forward really did believe that they were making the world a better place. Now, defined in various ways by different people over time, but there is this key feature, which I do think is unique partially to the United States in this sense of Protestant mission that is embedded in the country's founding from the 17th century forward. The City on a Hill speech, which is given by a pastor or lay leader before the Puritans even reached the United States in the 17th century, they're talking about building a city on a hill. Now, that city on the hill changes from something shining the light to going out and forcing people to become a city on a hill, but it was real. There was this notion that the new world was going to push capital P progress and capital H history in a direction. And I think what has defined really the last 10 years since 2015, 2016, is this total cynicism about that belief, that even that we look at the United States' foreign policy as primarily being driven by cynical incentives or realist objective incentives, and that is true, there is also this ideological superstructural notion to what's going on here. And I think what's unique about the current era is that we no longer have even that. That George W. Bush really did believe he was bringing democracy to the Middle East. I know that sounds crazy, but he really did believe this. Like, part of the American foreign policy establishment really did believe that going to Vietnam was going, you're going to turn South Vietnam into a liberal democratic capitalist state, and that was going to show the world what you can do. It wasn't the major or the sole reason, but it was a real primary reason. And I think we don't live in that world any longer. And so that is, I think, what came before, if we're connecting it to your question, what came before this moment of imperialist realism, this profound cynicism about the United States' place in the world. And how has it spread? Just very quickly, I think it's spread throughout pop culture. So you mentioned zombie movies. I think there's this notion that there's always an enemy out there. You saw it in basically everything zombie, but think about Game of Thrones. What is the message of the first few seasons of Game of Thrones? Is that there's an enemy out there. No one believes the people who are stationed on the wall that these white walkers are real, and then they're basically bit in the ass because of it. And I think this is a metaphor for American foreign policy that you see all over the place. And we could get into more pop cultural examples, but I think it's what the theorist Raymond Williams called a structure of feeling. It sort of limits the common sense of an era about what is and isn't possible.
So really, when we're talking about this new era where we have, which it seems to be most marked by the shedding of the delusion or artifice, depending on who wields it, but, you know, it existed enough as a actual delusion that it was able to be wielded as an artifice, that we are going to, in some way, based upon our perception, civilize the rest of the world, essentially. And, I mean, people can see this, like, it's as insane of an idea as it was. They were sending Heritage Foundation interns into Baghdad, and they weren't doing that because they thought, you know, their version of civilization was like, this is going to be a Milton Friedman paradise. We're going to privatize everything here. Everybody's going to make money, and this is going to work. And these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed Heritage Foundation interns who were running Iraq for 15 minutes really thought that they were spreading democracy and American freedom and Americanism. And so that's gone. And is that a Trump? Like, what accounts for this? Like, you say it's the failures of the war on terror. We had the longest wars that we've had, essentially, in this century of American, or I should say, throughout American history, happened in this century. Afghanistan is, you know, at least functioning in more so than people would have given Biden credit for, I think. But what is it, just Trump, or is it Trump plus, or I should say, is it just the failure of the sort of like the failure of Americatizing everything, or is it that plus Trump, who is now just sort of like, not even, we like the people who do good things for me, we don't like the people who don't, we're gonna be buddies with the guy who chopped up an American journalist into 100 million pieces because that's what's going to work for me.
Yeah, I mean, and to some degree, Trump is the ultimate example of the cynical elements of imperialist realism. And then there are people within his administration, like Marco Rubio, who does have an ideological commitment to, for example, preventing Latin America from what he envisions as going communist. I think this is all ultimately, to put it in more of a medium-term frame, a come down from the victory, quote-unquote, in the Cold War. Because what the victory in the Cold War did is that it essentially, and this is where my story plays into Fisher's story, even though he isn't as explicit about this, it basically removed political economic alternatives from viable consideration in a real way. So some people disagree with me, but I think this is increasingly becoming consensus. I think, for example, that basically every country in the world except North Korea has embraced some form of capitalism. China has a state capitalist form. We have a liberal democratic, though increasingly oligarchic form of capitalism. Russia has a kleptocratic oligarchic form of capitalism. Western European states have a more social democratic form of capitalism. But the key feature here is that capitalism, after the end of the Cold War and the disappearance or the dissipation of the communist alternative, has essentially conquered the globe. So one of the things is that I like to say is that Fukuyama was right, but for the wrong reasons. Because in his famous End of History essay, Fukuyama says that liberalism will be the last ideology. He thought that every country would become liberal, that once China embraced capitalism, political liberalism would follow. Same for the Soviet Union, cum Russia. But what actually happened is that once every country in the world embraced capitalism, the justifying ideology of liberalism, which accompanied the rise of capitalism in the 19th and 20th centuries in basically the quote-unquote Western world, really the North Atlantic world, it's that liberalism itself that's going away. You don't need that justifying ideology. So I think you see our politics here becoming increasingly illiberal, becoming increasingly authoritarian. But at the same time, what is quite strange is that there hasn't been another ideology to come up and replace it. Even what, you know, Trump ridiculously calls communists, or the fact that, you know, many people listening are democratic socialists, the horizon of democratic socialism is effectively a return to New Deal liberalism. It's not, you know, a transformation of the economy, having it run by various Soviets at the level of the workplace. So I think we have this moment where no alternative world is possible, which is ultimately an upshot of the end of political, economic, ideological challenges to liberal democracy in the Western world.
So if liberalism is sort of like, I guess, wilting on the vine, because there's no incentive structure to promote it now that there's no competition to capitalism around the world, you don't need to bring up the sort of like, this is how we justify capitalism, is because look how liberal our society is. And it's, you know, we're making educational gains. We're making sort of thought gains. We're, you know, we're moving we're evolving civilization in this way. And that's how we justify the sort of the greedy aspects of capitalism, because the greedy aspects of capitalism allow this sort of liberalism to flourish. But once that competition's gone, liberalism dies on the vine. Why does there have to be something that fills that vacuum?
I think you're exactly right. Like, people use that famous Gramsci quote, like, it's an interregnum and now is a time of monsters. The interregnum assumes a coming regnum. Things will change, right? Like, history is never static, whether it's an exogenous force like climate change or a meteor or an endogenous force that I am unable to see, things will change. But I think what is really unique about our moment is it feels static. And this is, I think, one of the reasons that, like, I don't know how you feel, Sam, but I feel always a little bit nuts all the time, because I think about nothing but politics. I'm posting about nothing but politics, but change structurally seems impossible. So we have this strange moment where you have this like extreme politicization, but there's no way to change things. And I think that has a negative psychic effect on basically everyone. And I think you see it reflected in increased polarization and politics, ironically, becoming the center of people's lives in a moment when we don't have the actual ability to change policy. It's ironically a function of that. But I think you're totally right. Nothing seems on the horizon to me. And I mean, the good news is that I think, at least in time will tell, I don't think like MAGA is going to create a hegemony like the New Deal liberals created a hegemony and the Democrats ran Congress for 50 years. I don't see that happening with the MAGA movement. So that's the good part. But the bad part is I think our politics will be increasingly sclerotic, where we'll go back and forth between political parties. Nothing will really change unless there's a genuinely revolutionary leader like FDR who's able to ready and willing to take on structures. Maybe AOC is that leader. I don't know. But I think we need someone like that. We don't need one Lena Khan. We need 5,000 Lena Khans. Right. And right now, that doesn't seem to be on the table.
All I'll say to be a little bit more positive is sometimes it's darkest before the dawn. Haven't you ever heard of that, Danny?
It's beautiful. That's have you not should, heard that? Should trademark
I
that.
Mean, I heard it, I think, from a Dead song, but I feel like it probably has a place in literary history. Do you think the increase in engagement? I don't know. I mean, I have some weird thoughts about the increase in engagement in this version of the Trump years. In some ways, it's increased, but it's also sort of like not looking at the right stuff, in my estimation. Not that there's right stuff, but or it's there's less awareness of the worst stuff. I should say that, which is, you know, in my estimation, the complete destruction of our government. In terms of the apparatus inside, people don't pay attention to that as much. There are other sort of like sexier things, but nothing that I think is going to resonate for as long as that. Like, to getting rid of the Treasury announced it's getting rid of the shell company database. Okay, we're just going to do that. It will take a decade or two to get back to if someone starts on day one and they have the resources to do it. Do you think that the increase in awareness of politics or engagement? I mean, because we do, regardless of maybe not focusing on what I want people to focus on, people are more engaged. Is that a function of the sort of liberalism dying, or is it coincidental?
I think a lot of things that seemed settled are no longer settled. And I think it took many people, including myself, a long time to recognize that over the last 10 years. For example, everyone always talks about the norms. Norms are basically just a form of settled social cultural opinion and what is acceptable and what is not. But clearly Trump has broken dozens, if not hundreds, of norms, and no one is able to do anything because the hegemonic ideology that underwrote those, which is small L liberalism, not liberalism in sort of the Democratic Party sense, but a type of procedural liberalism, which is that you value the institutions, which basically held true from FDR to Trump, even though obviously Reagan and George W. Bush are different than Clinton and Obama, though they did share several similarities, to say the least. They all agreed on sort of the rules of the game. And with the hegemony of liberalism coming apart because liberalism has failed to deliver to enough people, I think those rules are open to consideration again. Now, I mean, this could be positive. I mean, moments of destabilization could lead to moments of transition that obviously in this country, at least, are sorely needed. I mean, famously, we are now living in an era that is more wealth inequality than the Gilded Age. And that oligarchization has come to such a point where a small number of people control an enormous amount of wealth, and this is just unable to last. So I think that this is necessarily an open for a moment for re-questioning. The problem, though, is that the American state that you just highlighted, Sam, has been designed to prevent people, ordinary people, from accumulating power. So there is this tension where everyone knows it needs to change, but the people don't have the institutional power to enact the change. Usually in those moments, that leads to some form of revolutionary transformation. But the way that I put it is it's not 1917 or 1789. No group of citizens is able going to take on any modern military in a genuine way, which is why my co-host Derek on American Prestige, he often jokes like, when are the drone strikes against citizens going to start? Which is just basically saying that it's very difficult to take on an American state, or really any state that has the monopoly of violence, which is why I don't recommend it. I don't think a revolutionary strategy has any chance of succeeding. But then the institutional strategy also seems like a very, you know, Sisyphean path forward. So again, I'm raising questions more than providing answers. And this is what leads to this realism notion that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than basically any political transformation, whether you're talking about capitalist transformation or talking about imperialist transformation. And I think that's the moment in which we find ourselves.
A, I would say Derek does not know what a joke structure is. B, I would ask, like, do you think like this this era that we're living in of imperialist realism, and it also exists alongside the other sort of like realism where we can't imagine a broader future. But this, you're specifically talking in terms of foreign policy, which is Trump a symptom of that, or is he a catalyst in terms of like, I mean, is this is the imperialist realism experienced just by the people, or is it also, do you think, experienced by the people who are in the foreign policy, you know, realm or institutions, or do they even exist anymore in the same way because of Trump, who is like, I'm just doing whatever, you know, Putin was in my ear, and then, you know, I was really impressed with the Chinese, you know, dishware, and so, you know, whatever it is.
I think Trump is both a symptom and the cause in the sense that he's an intensification. So Trump is obviously like just extraordinarily cynical. He doesn't even make any ideological claims in any way whatsoever. The United States is not, you know, taking down Iran to turn it into a democracy, like would have been said during
George. Was it not about the supposed 30,000 people that
Iran killed? Yeah, 5 million protesters killed. I mean, a lot of people were killed, but not the numbers that were given out. I think what estimates are like 11,000, but don't quote me on that. But they said something like, but not 40 or 50,000. But anyway, it's not to make the country democratic. It's not to help the green movement. It's to basically get the oil. He literally says that. But you also find that cynicism under Biden. For example, like think about all the tirelessly working for a ceasefire.
Right.
That the Biden administration was talking about vis-a-vis Gaza. I mean, it just, the more and more information that comes out, that just is not true. That you have Israeli officials effectively saying they never told us to stop. And ironically, from my understanding, is that in Israel, they kept on going because they thought the Americans were going to do what they usually do, which is eventually tell them to stop, and they just never did. So they just kept on going. So I think cynicism is something that basically crosses party lines, and as is the missionism. What you get less in the Trump administration that you had a lot of in Biden was this notion of guilt, was this notion that we had to act, otherwise someone else would act. There's less of that in Trump himself and the coterie of people around him, but I still think that notion of tragic guilt is a substrate of American politics. But what Trump has certainly done is that he's intensified it. You know, the Biden administration is like, oh, they hem and haw, but we have to give Israel this money and this weapons, but we feel terrible about it. You know, it's to combat terrorism. Trump has none of that feel terrible about it. So in that sense, it's even an intensification of this real, quote unquote, realism of imperialist realism. And what comes next? I don't know, because I think it might turn out to be that this was an artifact of our gerontocracy, that we have people who came of political age in a very peculiar historical moment of American power, and maybe a President Buttigieg or even a President Vance would approach things differently. Difficult to know, but that remains to be seen.
I want to just put a pin in that and get to like what the potential, what it might look like for a different generation. But what is the, I mean, I understand that the, you know, the capitalist realism was a metaphor and a structure for you to understand and explain imperialist realism. But how much does where we are in terms of capitalism, and maybe this also speaks to the absence of another system in the wake of the end of the Cold War that has sort of like made it so unbridled and that, but like, you know, I'm like, how much of that informs our cynicism today? I mean, I'm thinking of like Brent McGurk, for instance, who I suspect we might find out had even more outsized influence over Biden than we thought. I mean, this is not in any way to exculpate Biden, but that who knows how conscious Biden was of anything. And McGurk clearly a serious ideologue and is now working like, he's making reams and reams of cash for venture capital and Middle Eastern wheeling and dealing with all of the people who stood to gain from this conflict. I mean, it's just money hand over fist. And I wonder if, like that's got to, there is a quality with this generation that has been in power of, like, we're getting ours before the bank closes its doors or whatever it is, whatever the metaphor is. But we're getting ours now. So there's this, like, mass, almost like getaway car feel where it's like, who cares what happens in the wake of this? We're going to have our cash and maybe I'll be living in a bunker in New Zealand or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny with the bunker stuff. Who do you think is going to be the first person to lose power in a post-apocalyptic society? The people who have the money. So that strategy never made sense. It'd be about 5 seconds before the mercenaries took over those bunkers. But anyway, I think what you're describing, Sam, is that there's been this decrease in the sense of national feeling. That if you go back to the 50s and the 60s, when the CEOs only made 20 times as opposed to 20,000 times or whatever the number is in their employees, there was a sense of common purpose and common nationhood. And though I have to explore this in more depth, I think a lot of that is linked to mass participation in war. So you think about Mad Men, right? The show Mad Men. Roger Sterling was a veteran of World War II, and he was about as elite as it can possibly get, but he was a combat veteran of the Pacific Theater. That gave people like that a sense of identity with other people who served in the war, and everyone basically served in the war in one capacity or another. And so I think this is how, like, empire comes in. Since the decline of mass war, when the draft ended in the 1970s, and now we're basically 50 plus years out of that, Trump rags about avoiding the Vietnam War. What is his famous line? Avoiding venereal disease was his Vietnam. Right. I think there's been a decline in sense of common nationness and common nationhood because there's been a significant decline in shared experience. Again, to go to pop culture, the sort of stereotype of the World War II movies, you have one, a guy from the South, a guy from Brooklyn,
yeah,
you know, a Puerto Rican guy, a Jewish guy. And obviously there are certain people who aren't there, namely people of African descent. But that this is still this common coming together across class and ethnicity. And we haven't had any mass experience like that in literal decades. People experienced the Great Recession very differently than based on class. People experienced the war on terror. I mean, for me,
People experienced COVID differently based on those things, too, which theoretically you could imagine in a different era might be something that would bring people together, I guess, as a shared experience, but no.
That's a perfect example. That's a perfect example. And we have nothing like that. So when there's no sense of common belonging in a nation, you get people who are just basically trying to, you know, steal the hubcaps off of the remaining tires that still exist in the American empire. And we live obviously in an incredibly corrupt, incredibly oligarchic era. And I think the open question for people like us and people coming behind us is how do we change that? How do we give a sense of nationhood without fighting devastating wars or going through terrible experiences? I think this is really an open question, but it's clearly that sense of common belonging has come apart. And that common belonging was, I think, a way that capitalism was tempered in a genuine way, that it was inappropriate to make 40,000 times what, you know, your employee made because you were participating in a common project. And no one believes that.
Those guys on the factory floor, they may have saved your life in battle or in some fashion. How much? That's fascinating. It's also, I have to say, a little bit depressing because you don't want to necessarily have a war where everybody's going to have to enlist to bring the country together. 9/11 did not bring the country together either. I mean, it certainly, maybe there was an opportunity to do so. The only thing that Bush asked of people was to keep shopping.
Yep.
And they did, you know, to the extent that they could. Would the emancipation movements of the 60s also have added, if the absence of a shared experience was one factor in undermining or creating the cynicism of, like, we're all in this for ourselves. And so was the emancipatory movements, women, black people in the 60s, did that also contribute to it? The idea that, like, we got to just get our own on some level?
It's interesting. I think those movements were, to some degree, at least in a formal political sense, quite successful. But two of the largest projects that they undertook beyond the sort of identity-based notions, which I think are crucial. I'm not a class-first leftist. I think it is important to focus on identity, gender, sexual, racial, ethnic identity, in addition to class identity. But what they weren't able to really shift was the class and imperialist identity. And this is, you know, this is exactly what Martin Luther King Jr. was turning to right before he was assassinated. It was the Poor People's March. It was the focus, now that we've got these civil rights based on race, now we've got to turn towards combating capitalism and
the structure that disempowered these people in the first place. Yes.
And imperialism. And though, you know, for those conspiracy theorists out there, that's a claim as to why he was assassinated, because he was now taking on the two fundamental structures, which were capitalism and imperialism. So I think those movements, while successful in their own right in very significant ways, didn't basically take the two sort of pylons of the United States' global hegemony in the second half of the 20th century. He wasn't able to take those two on. I mean, it was obviously a very difficult thing. I haven't taken them on either, and no one has since.
But I wonder if some of the cynicism is also a function of the backlash. I'm not making a critique of the emancipatory movements. I am making a critique of the white guy who, you know, what's his face in Mad Men. He also would have had an issue. Not only does he no longer have that connection to his, fellow man, white man, frankly, because he didn't, you know, we don't have a World War II experience, but he's also now looking around going like, wait a second, I can't comment on my secretary's legs. There's a black guy in the office next door to me, and he's not bringing me my sandwich. Like, what's going on here? I mean, that seems absolutely, like it's a big part of it that has to also add to this sense of like, F this, country's gone to hell, I'm just getting mine.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think there was a racialist backlash, and there was a gender backlash against people losing their hegemonic position in society. And this didn't help that this also happened at the very same time that deindustrialization really destroyed the working class amongst large portions of American society. And so I think the sort of gender and racial, and one might also add sexual backlash, coupled with deindustrialization, created a cynicism amongst the emergent racialized elite that did lead them to just be like, leave behind the sense of common nationness, nationhood, and common belonging that was never regenerated because World War II receded further and further into the past. And I actually talk about this a bit on my Substack. I published a piece called The End of the Nazi Taboo, which is that we see this emergence of all this Nazi stuff in recent years. And I think that's also partially an artifact of World War II retreating more and more into the past, that a lot of the norms that were set up by that war, that you don't screw over everyone in your company, that you don't wear a swastika unless you're literally a Hell's Angel, are starting to come apart as liberalism itself comes apart. So it's just like a totalizing thing that is happening right now.
You write in the book, and you give a vision of what a democratic socialist foreign policy would look like: democracy, accountability, anti-militarism, threat deflation, and internationalism. I know you go through this on the Substack as well on a regular basis, or piecemeal as it works. But what do you anticipate will come next? I mean, hope springs eternal. It would be great if we had your prescription of a foreign policy. But what comes next in the wake of something like this? I mean, let's presume for a moment that Donald Trump does not run for a third term, does not win for a third term, maybe even, you know, people pass away, Daniel. And that would be, of course, nature's way of telling us that it was time for Donald Trump to leave. But what comes after this? Like, it seems to me we're always at a crossroads, but it's almost as if in the past, when we are at crossroads, there's two paved options that are going And now we're just at the end of the road, and it's all just sandy terrain, or like, you know, like, I just imagine like a road that was planned to go through a desert, and halfway through they ran out of money and they said, screw it, we're ending it here, and that we're going to end there. And it feels like we could go in any direction. What's your sense of, like, is there a riverbed that maybe we'll follow, or what do you think it'll be?
Well, to some degree, American history is unique because we're a presidential system, and presidential systems tend to have gigantic transformations, much more so than parliamentary systems, which by almost structure incorporate more radical criticisms into the major political parties. And to some sense, in some sense, we're overdue. If you think about American history, it goes in roughly 80-year cycles from the founding to the Civil War, which was defined by early industrialization and the replacement of the agrarian southern class by the northern merchant class, from the Civil War to the New Deal, when you have basically the introduction of social democracy in the New Deal. And what we're witnessing now, I think, is a full coming apart of the New Deal order. And frankly, Obama had a chance in 2008 and 2009 to genuinely transform the political economy of the United States by, for example, nationalizing the banks, yep, not bailing out Wall Street, it's really wild. Not only not bailing out Wall Street, but, you know, having the Fed, obviously he doesn't control the Fed, but the Fed then creating zero interest rates, which allowed surviving companies to purchase every other company. We're in media. That has happened in media. So I think that what could come next to sort of be on a positive, put it on a positive note, end on a positive note here, is something genuinely revolutionary. That once the gerontocratic oligarchy of the baby boomers, at least their political hold, stranglehold, goes away when they literally die, when younger politicians are elected, even perhaps someone who is a Republican, we could maybe see genuine transformation, or at least transformations that are more in line with the political reality of, you know, the period after 1980, as opposed to the political reality of 1950 to 1975. So we could hope for that. I think a lot of it depends on who wins municipal elections. Are there going to be more Zoran Mandanis? Is it going to be AOC or Buttigieg? Is it going to be a Democrat or a Republican? But I do think that once the gerontocracy itself begins to wither away, literally, we could see some positive changes in a way that we haven't seen in quite a long time.
Well, hope springs eternal. That's certainly been the, you know, the reed that I've been hanging on to as the the water overflows the banks. And Daniel Bessner, the book is Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century. You could check out Daniel's Substack, Imperialist Realism. We will put a link to both the book and the Substack, and American Prestige as well, the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And congratulations on the book.
Thanks, Sam. I'm content maxing, as you could see. Have a great
totally
rest of your
day. Totally content maxing. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. All right, folks. Edward Gregorian, I can't believe you didn't ask for a Thanos reference when he said, I can do more pop culture references. Seems like a missed opportunity, Sam. I'm not mad at you, but I'm disappointed. I understand. Folks. What's that? Oh, gosh. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm sorry about that. I completely blanked. When we come back, we'll be talking to Elijah Manley, running for Congress in Florida's 20th district. Yep. We'll be right back after this. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland is out today. Joining us now, Elijah Manley. He is a candidate in the Democratic primary in Florida's 20th congressional district. This primary is tomorrow. Elijah is his main opponent at this point is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who doesn't even live in the district. And is threatening to take away what has been a traditionally black represented district in Florida. Elijah, welcome to the program. Why did you enter this race?
Yes, Sam. Well, I entered this race back in January of last year. And I got into it because obviously we saw Donald Trump come back into office and we saw, you know, affordability crisis. We saw ICE terrorizing our communities. And I made a decision to get in the race because I thought our Democratic Party was not doing the right thing. They didn't have any real leadership. The party was broken. And I wanted to give it a try. This was well before they did redistricting. I was running against a Democrat that had, you know, federal investigations against her for fraud and PPP fraud. So I got in the race and we had a pretty decent campaign going on for a while, and then redistricting hit us. That Democrat got indicted. We saw redistricting, and then Debbie Wasserman Schultz made the decision to come jump over here in this seat in May.
We should say that Democrat, she resigned in April, but she's running again in the new district. Is that right?
That's right. She's still running after resigning in April for essentially stealing $6 million from the state of Florida and the federal government and COVID relief money. And she resigned. She had to resign for it. And, you know, the primary was pretty much over at that point in April because she was the only real contender against me, the incumbent. And once she got out of the race and dropped out, it was pretty much done deal. And then literally 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later or not even 2 weeks later, they dropped the congressional map, a new congressional map in Florida, where they took away four Democratic seats. They chopped the district up a little bit. They kept this district intact, although they shrunk it a little bit. But this is a seat that was created in 1992 under the Voting Rights Act forcibly to make sure that black Floridians had the ability to elect a candidate of our choice to Congress. And it's been that way for 34 years, first with Alcee Hastings, the late Alcee Hastings, and now it was Sheila Surface McCormick. Now the seat is vacant. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she could just run over here in this seat.
Yeah, it's first off, it's shocking to think like, oh, wait a second, redistricting has helped me with we have more voters in this district who are excited about somebody who has had to resign because of fraud. But here's Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and she doesn't even live in the district. Is that right?
She lives in Weston. She wouldn't even be her own congresswoman. That's the funny part.
Are you allowed to do that?
You are allowed to do it. You just have to live in the state of Florida. But the Constitution doesn't prohibit someone from representing a different district.
So what tell me what you have been doing up to this point and what people can do over the course of the next essentially 24 hours to help you win, because she is basically hoping for the other four candidates in the race to split the vote and walk in to a congressional seat, which it's not even her own district, with like 35-40% of the vote. That's what seems like she's that's what her game plan seems to be.
Yeah, that's what she's banking on. But we've been knocking doors and phone banking all day today and for the past few months to meet voters where they are and communicate with them. And I think we're seeing a surge in the district, but we still need some help. So if you have some time to phone bank, please sign up. And if you are in South Florida area, you want to join us for a canvas, we have one today. But I get, you know, not everybody can be here for a canvas. So the phone banking helps. You can still contribute to the campaign to help us out. But this is going to come down to the wire, because every vote literally does matter. This seat was decided by 5 votes 5 years ago. So anything could happen here.
Actual votes.
5 votes in a crowded field.
Wow.
And that is how Sheila got in.
So this is about, in many respects, really mobilizing. And I imagine the fact that the districts were redistricted so late has made it very challenging to inform people exactly, you know, what Debbie Wasserman Schultz is doing, aside from all of the sort of like highly problematic positions she has had, whether she was chair of the DNC or as a congressperson. Just the idea that she doesn't even live in the district seems to be just insane to me.
Yeah, it was intentional, too. So she waited. The map was signed in early May. She waited until a week before the filing deadline to officially announce. And that was intentional, to keep people on edge, to hold on to her cash, to drown everybody else's voice out and give nobody time to react. So, you know, that drowned out a lot of donors and supporters. And then she got in a race with, you know, like $3 million and a ton of AIPAC support. We didn't have the time to raise enough money to really give her, you know, much of a fight, but we've been doing the best that we could in the field, and I think it's working. But we raised about $1.3 million to her $3 million and, you know, the $400,000 that AIPAC has dropped in this race in just a week. And so we've been fighting, you know, fighting back on that front. But she waited intentionally to the last week so that she could take full advantage of a split field and make it harder for anybody to raise money.
Wow. All right. Well, listen, I know you got campaigning to do. Tell us where people can go to phone bank for you. Or for that matter, canvas if they're in the neighborhood.
I would say go to our Mobilize page, or you can go to ElijahManley.com to sign up for a phone banking shift or for canvas if you're in the neighborhood.
And Elijah, just tell us briefly, just give us the top line of your, I mean, you've been endorsed by the PCCC. You have all sorts of endorsements. Your personal story is absolutely just impressive. And my understanding is you grew up homeless in Fort Lauderdale. You've gone on to be a teacher. But tell us about your positions. Just to inspire people to go over. There's many hours left where a phone campaigning can make a difference in a race that could be down to 5 votes. I mean, in the past.
That's right. Literally every call. But, you know, in my case, I'm a progressive solidly. And, you know, I'm a supporter of Medicare for All. I believe in a country as wealthy as ours, there's no reason why anybody should be without health care in this country. So when I get to Congress, I'm going to be co-sponsoring and sponsoring Medicare for All, taking on the drug companies and insurance companies that have been pretty much gouging the American people, ending forever wars and genocide in Gaza, and also standing up for our democracy. I think the Democratic Party in many ways have gone silent and allowed Donald Trump to destroy the country without any real opposition from the weak leaders that we have in Washington, D.C. And so I want to go there and be a part of the resistance to this administration, but also an agenda for the future as well, raising wages, providing people health care as a human right, stopping and ending wars, and making sure American dollars go to building America up and not forever wars overseas.
Elijah Manley, we will put a link to your sites where folks can go and phone bank or to get in touch and figure out what's the best way to canvas. Good luck tomorrow. Really appreciate you coming on and appreciate the fight that you've been putting up against Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the other opponents you have in this race. Hopefully we'll be talking to you on the other side of this as the Democratic nominee.
Absolutely. Can't wait for it.
All right, Elijah Manley, we will put your stuff on Majority Report in our YouTube and podcast description. Thanks again.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. You heard it. We will put links right now in the podcast and YouTube descriptions and at majority.fm. You know, make 20 calls. It'll take you maybe an hour and a half. Who knows? Wasserman Schultz obviously has the advantage, but next time they won't be splitting the vote like this, I don't think, down there.
The thing about not living in the district, is that different state by state?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah, a lot of times a lot of times you have to live in the district that you represent.
Why?
Because I know people, yeah, who are like...
She understands what's best for them. You got to trust her.
Yeah, she's done such a great job with the National Party, so...
I mean, I remember back when she was the DNC chair during the Obama years. It seemed to be well known that Obama did not like her. They wanted her to go away, but they just didn't want to expend any capital on fighting her about it. That was it. That's what I understood. Like, nobody thought that she was competent, which is impressive.
Did you ask Neera Tanden?
Huh? I think even Neera Tanden probably didn't think that she was competent. Like, she couldn't, like... She couldn't give Hillary the advantage without it being subtle. Like, you have one job to do. Just, you know, do it. Like, don't leave any fingerprints. But, Article 1 of the Constitution states representatives in the House need to live in the state, but not living in the district is not one, not a requirement, says Brooklyn Progressive. So there it is. Matt can't handle the truth. Matt looks like he's about to pass out. He's so, shocked.
It's just like I've heard people that, like, run for office and they move to a place that they probably, frankly, wouldn't have lived.
Well, you can't. This is the thing.
Talking about Hillary?
You can't call her.
Yeah,
you can't,
my friend Hillary.
You can't call her a carpetbagger because she didn't even.
Didn't even pack up.
She didn't even pack up.
Yeah. She didn't bag her carpet.
Nope.
Did she at least have a pied-à-terre?
You would think. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And more than anything else, what you do is you help this show survive and thrive. Week in, week out, day in, day out. We try and give you interviews and news stories that help you understand our politics. If you enjoy the show, support the show. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. That's where you can buy fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. If you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off. They have all sorts of blends and single origins. They're a great co-op that really support their farmers and suppliers of coffee. JustCoffee.coop. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckie and media universe?
Yeah, Left Reckoning on our Sunday show last night for Left Reckoning patrons. We talked about Sri Thanadar, who is taking a loss well by going surfing and quoting Nelson Mandela. Also talking about the Texas races, all the races, the Democrats are looking pretty good there, though David says, you know, not to trust polling, but check out where we're talking about Ken Paxton blaming his primary race for the reason why James Tallarico has everyone so nervous on the right side of things down there.
I am congressional baseball fan, said Sam. It's my birthday. All I really want to hear about is your top Apple picks for autumn 2026. They're not terribly different than they would have been from 2025. Although I will say that at least in New York State, banner year. But I would go with a Snapdragon or a Crimson Crisp. And if you can get your hands, it's a little bit late on a pristine. I would go for the pristine as well. That's I tried to give you a mix of apples there. But Snapdragon still remains my favorite. Don't come at me about Honeycrisp. I get it. It's nice. It's not terribly sophisticated. Also requires a lot of spraying. That's the dirty little secret they don't tell you about. So, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow,
What? What is that going on? It's nuts! Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Boo.
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for a
ride. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today for the fun half. Carl Barks. I don't want to spam, so I won't send again today. I just don't know how the IM screen works. Shofar request. Today, we lost my namesake. Carl Barks was the best boy, a goofy dog, and I'm going to miss him very much. So sorry. Very difficult to lose a pet. Carl Barks, this goes out to you, buddy, heading over that rainbow bridge. Bad Tort Pounder. Bad Torta Pounder. Your first guest expressed his support to prioritize identity politics, which is very interesting considering Mark Fisher's essay, Exiting the Vampire's Castle. What's your take on that essay? My first take is you didn't listen very carefully to what he said. He did not say...
He didn't say anything about exiting the Vampire Castle.
Well, he also did not say that he prioritized identity politics. He simply said that he was not a class essentialist.
And the Mark Fisher piece he referenced was Capitalist Realism.
I would say that would be my reaction. It's been a while since I read Exiting the Vampire Castle. I know it was one of Michael's faves. And so, to be honest with you, it's been too long since I have read it. But broadly speaking, I am also not a class essentialist. I think in the context of the U.S., we have to address both. And I'm not convinced that dealing with class issues will deal with racial issues. I think particularly in this era that we live in, compensation comes in many forms for people. What is material to me or what is not material to me appears to be material to some people. Their social status outside of economics, it's not enough that they, you know, have the two-car garage in the McMansion. They also have to make sure that black people know their place.
I mean, I don't think, like, I would say to, it's been a while since I've read Exiting the Vampire Castle 2, but my recollection of it is it's more similar on the lines of Michael saying, be kind to people and ruthless with systems, which I think is fair enough and something to still, accept as a general rule of thumb. I'd also say one thing I do remember about Exiting the Vampire Castle is the person that he... used, unfortunately, as an example of someone you should be comradely and call in instead of call out is Russell Brand, and that hasn't aged well.
Who did that?
In Exiting the Vampire Castle. Like, he got on people because they were criticizing Russell Brand for being a little bit uncouth in terms of...
I didn't know that. I don't remember it.
But that was before all
Russell Brand.
Yeah, Exiting the Vampire Castle. If my recollection is right, it explicitly references him, which hasn't aged well, unfortunately. But I think the general point is still one to accept.
Yeah. Sprungfeld, Mass. Can you get Jerome Whalen and or Jason Poulos on ahead of voting next week? I'd really like to see Richie Neal and Jake Oschensloss cry. Richie Neal, longtime Ways and Means chair, from like North Adams, Mass. And Oschensloss is like, I can't remember what district, in the eastern Massachusetts. Maybe. Roxy Amused. I'm sure the apples you get to taste are sophisticated, but out of reach for some of us poor. Would love access to some nice heirloom apples or whatever, but when you have five varieties, even the nicest stories, you take what you can get. Yeah, look, I mean, I get my apples up at, like, the farmer's market in New York City. If you don't have access to Snapdragons, then, you know, and all you get are the supermarket varieties, you know, you go for a Pink Lady or a Gala or a Fuji. I mean, you know, it's not like these apples, these other apples are that much more expensive. They're not. It's just that you don't have access to them because they don't necessarily travel as well. The reason why your Galas, the reason why your delicious apples were, you know, commodified in the way that they were is because they travel well. Essentially, that's basically it. I wasn't saying, like, get a Macoun, which, of course, you don't have access to because that's not going to travel anywhere. It's going to get bruised and they're not going to sell it. So
I refuse to look this up. I have no idea if this is a bit where you're just making up apple names every time you talk.
You're not fact-checking his apple rants? That's your job, Brian.
Guys.
You better write this all up for the summary description.
Somebody pointed out yesterday that I was wrong on the pristine window of harvesting in Zone 5, and you guys never corrected me.
That's a producer
error.
And
now I got to go out the next day and tell everybody, I'm sorry, in Zone 5, obviously this apple's not available the second week of August. It was picked 3 weeks ago.
I have a specific AI trained on.
And I embarrass myself in front of people.
I take full responsibility for that. No, I'm sorry.
Let's go into this. I am so old that I remember when the right would claim that, like, Democrats dishonor the troops and all of these hippies spit on the people coming back from Vietnam and Democrats don't care about the troops and we've got to make our fighting guys and gals, they got to get the best of the best. That's why we're spending, you know, $70,000 in giving them rigs to wear in Iraq and whatnot. Well, so much for that. Here is Fox host Joey Jones.
What?
I love the fact that these dudes probably have, like, radio names now. Like, my name was Joseph Pitsapoudis, and I decided to change my name to Joey Jones. Go ahead.
I mean, how weak are you on TV complaining about tuna and noodles? I'm sorry. You volunteered to serve your country. You can come back, get out of the military, and do like all of these Democrat veterans and complain about it and make commercials and be a sellout if you want to and come up with a new way of doing things. The last Democrat president that I remember that was deploying troops, Barack Obama, had the army going to Iraq on patrol bases for 15 months at a time eating MREs. I'm sorry, but you're a sitting duck on a patrol base in Iraq, in Afghanistan, a heck of a lot more than you are on a fortified Navy ship sitting in the water. You might have got bored, and I'm sorry. We did have more fun getting in firefights, I'll say that. But to sit there and say that it was terrible because you had a corn dog and a hot dog, I would have traded a block of C4 to the Taliban for a hot dog by about July 2010. I just do not understand the mentality. If this is a representation of who our military is now, and I'm not saying it is, but there's at least enough for some of these trash rags to print about it. If this is who we are, we're just Rome sitting here waiting to burn. We've got nothing left. It makes me fume. If he sat there and said, we didn't have any clean water to drink, we couldn't take a shower. I mean, well, I didn't get to take a shower for about 6 months, but still, you know, something that has something to do with hygiene or, you know, like getting sick. There was a scurvy outbreak and, you know, the guys that were missing legs were only given wooden pegs instead of metal ones. Then maybe I might have some sympathy. But to that little kid and whoever raised him, Lord help you if you ever go into a hot war on the ground like millions of Americans have. I can only think what a World War II veteran sitting there who's lucid enough today to see that and think about the six-month journey home from fighting the toughest war we've ever fought after being there for 4 years was thinking, listening to him complain like that. The Secretary of the Navy put out his response. That's my response. End of story.
So Joey Jones lost, I think, both his legs in, I think it was Afghanistan. And so he gets sent out there to essentially, and I would imagine that you've got to look back and attempt to move on. In some instances, you got to try and justify, why you were there, why you lost your legs. And if it gives you the opportunity to mock other military personnel who are essentially being completely ignored. I mean, like the idea that we're understand. These people have been deployed now for almost 290 days on a ship that has been not provided with proper rations because they don't want to let people know that the bases that we had were destroyed by the Iranians.
Yeah.
Here are some images.
This is from Seth Harp, who wrote the Fort Bragg cartel vet himself, I believe. Actually, I need to check that. But anyway, he writes a lot about this stuff, and he has good sources. This is some of the chow that you can expect from this. And here, this is going to be gross, so just be prepared for this one, folks. This is the sort of plumbing situation they got. You can see, like, these knobs are completely off. And this next one's gross. And that's what they are putting up with this entire time. And so this isn't just about the troops. Like, I've definitely have a lot of sympathy for these young people that signed up for, basically the benefits and now are on this floating container. This is what we've been wasting our money on, supposedly. We give huge sums of money to the Pentagon, and where is it going? Like, that, this is the conditions that these guys are under? Like, where is it? This is a scandal. This is what DOE should be looking after. We are being robbed.
Yep. There's no doubt. I bet you the bathrooms of the executives getting all of the contracts for the stuff look a lot nicer.
Yeah. I'm honestly shocked by how shabby this stuff is. And the first day of the outbreak of the war, when they killed the service members with the drones or whatever, and you realize it's not like we've created state of the art bases that are really secure for our troops. They're in shipping containers.
Yep. It'll be interesting to see if Joey Jones ends up getting some type of promotion from the White House. Yeah. Right. If this is what Trump wants, because on one hand, Trump likes it. Got to be tough. But he's also in denial that any of this is happening. And so you can't have it both ways. You can't say the military personnel are wimps because they're complaining about, they're jumping off the boat or they're trying to commit suicide or whatever it is. But also pretend like it's not happening. Here's Donald Trump. This is clip number 14. And they woke him up to give a speech. This is him at the Nassau County Police Academy.
So I just say this. So for you to pay a tiny little bit more for your gasoline, just remember, you're doing it so that a very evil country cannot have a country. Really, it's the number one state sponsor of terror in the world. We don't want to have them have a nuclear weapon. So remember that when you have to pay a little bit more, you're at $4. It's okay. I mean, it's I'm not. I'll never apologize. I did the right thing. But you could, if you didn't have, you'd be.
Now, wait a second. This is weird. He's saying it's okay to have expensive gas because of he wanted to do the right thing. And what was it, ostensibly keep Iran from getting the nuclear weapon that they were not getting before he tore up the treaty. I'm not going to nitpick, but it is interesting that J.D. Vance earlier had said number one job is to get oil prices down. Number two job is the nuclear stuff. And then Trump was like, you're giving up the game. Yeah. You're admitting that we've lost. And he tweets out that, no, number one job is nuclear.
Hey, JD, no daylight, kid.
Yeah. No daylight. I wonder if this is JD Vance essentially ahead of, if he is about to separate himself and do so more aggressively. I mean,
go back to saying Trump is Hitler again.
I will tell you, if the Democrats take the Senate and the House, very likely they're going to take the House. Not so much with the Senate, and who knows with Fetterman, if it's 50-50, he will flip 100%. But if Democrats control the Senate and the House, I would not be surprised to see J.D. Vance almost outwardly in a hostile relationship with Trump.
When's the last time you've seen a vice president do that?
Never.
I mean, Hubert Humphrey.
Hubert Humphrey.
In September, before the election, war. Broke with
so college
LBJ.
That would have been just after college. No, that was not allowed. That was not alive. You see Donald Trump up there announcing, "You got to suck it up, everybody."
Gasoline.
I get it. $4 a gallon. Believe me. Nobody likes that less than me.
It's old-fashioned word gasoline.
Every time I pump my old gas, I feel like a patriot.
It's amazing. And I put that credit card down, and actually I take a loan to get gas, and then I don't repay the loan. Look, this has been hard. I know for some people who are not me, you have not made billions of dollars because I'm president. I have.
Should have worked harder.
You should have worked harder. But we absolutely have to pretend like I haven't lost this war. So that's what it's going to cost. In the meantime, apparently, even Republicans are getting a little tired of this. People who might have voted for Trump last time are starting to have second thoughts, and I wonder why.
But the key questions is, this November, what will happen to some of those voting blocks that swung a little bit toward Donald Trump, toward President Trump in 2024? Will those groups who were away from him but swung toward him stay with him? With us now, CNN chief data analyst Harry Enten. One of those key groups is
Hispanic men. Hispanic men. Donald Trump put up a historically strong performance for Republican candidate for president amongst Hispanic men. But the phrase this morning for President Trump is "Ay caramba," because look at these shifts. I mean, Hispanic men on Trump. In 2024, he won among Hispanic men by 10 points. Look now where his net approval rating is. Down he goes into the Gulf of Mexico, minus 41 points in an average of polls this year. That is, Johnny B, by my math, a 51-point switcheroo against the President of the United States. All of that movement that you saw, that historic performance that President Trump had amongst Hispanic men, adios, amigos, goodbye, see you later. As Johnny B was telling me backstage, these numbers are bonkers.
I mean, that's a huge swing. Huge. A 51 swing is huge. What might be one reason? What is one issue area where we're seeing the impact of this?
Yeah, it's the economy. It's the economy. We're seeing this across the board, but you're specifically seeing it amongst Hispanic men. I mean, just look at these numbers
Wow.
here. Okay, Hispanic men on Trump in the economy. He was more trusted than Kamala Harris on the economy by 11 points. Look at this. You thought a 50-plus point swing was huge. Look at now. His net approval rating here is 49 points underwater in an average polls. That is a 60-point move away from the president of the United States on the issue that got him reelected to a second term. It really helped swing Hispanic men into the Republican column to a historic degree. And all of that movement, all that hard work that Republicans made and did for the 2024 election, it all is just basically gone at this point. A huge swing back against the Republican President Donald John Trump.
Okay, how might this manifest itself in the midterms?
Yeah, okay, so it is one thing that you're seeing these big moves among President Trump, right? You're seeing these big moves among Hispanic men for President Trump. But the key question is, will this actually matter when it comes to the ballot boxes? It's one thing to not like somebody else, but will you actually pull the lever for the other party? Just look at this. Okay, choice for Congress, Hispanic men. Republicans won them by 8 points. Look now. Democrats ahead by 20 points. So, yes, what we're seeing amongst Hispanic men and their views of President Trump very much diving towards the negative absolutely look like they're going to have a massive impact on the midterm elections. Hispanic men now favoring the Democrats by 20. That is, as I finish this out, a 28-point swing against the Republican Party.
That seems bad for them.
Mass deportations now.
Imagine if in an alternative universe we did not spend 8 years calling Donald Trump MAGA.
Yeah.
But we actually called him a Republican. And we said, this is the Republican Party, ladies and gentlemen. This is who they back. This is who they support. This is who they will never, ever betray. This is the Republican Party. Republican Trump, Trump Republicans is okay if you need to, but the word Republican, the idea that you could make it as toxic as the Republicans have made the brand Democrats, which is not to say that the Democrats don't have responsibility for failing
to meet people's expectations, but you can still do politics properly. Hopefully, we are past the era of Democrats wanting to protect Republicans. Don't take my word for it. Nancy Pelosi told you years ago, we need a strong Republican Party.
Check.
Joe Biden said, the fever's going to break. What's the implication that there's a sub, like, this is not essential to being a Republican. It's just some type of like illness that they're going through. They caught a virus. They'll be okay. No, ladies and gentlemen, they won't be okay. This has been headed in this direction for decades.
Yeah, Goldwater.
Decades. And Democrats just stood by and watched it happen. And then protected them. In fact, at one point they were protecting MAGA. Why else would you have a term, extreme MAGA? It's one thing to say MAGA is extreme. It's better to say Republicans are extreme. Extremist Republicans. You're not talking about a cohort of Republicans. You're describing Republicans. And believe me, this is not because they were stupid. They were trying to protect a Republican constituency. And they thought, like, oh, if we criticize the Republican Party, then the Republican voters are going to feel like under attack. No, if you make the Republican brand toxic, people will disassociate themselves from the Republican Party. Let's just play one last clip. This number seven. Well, which one is this? Let's try number eight. This is Bobby Kennedy, who, you know, it's very difficult to put a dollar figure on the cost of a person's soul. But if you want to see what someone looks like and how they respond to questions after they have sold their soul, this is a good example. I mean, this is just naked debasing for transactional gain by Bobby Kennedy.
The type that he criticized in Trump's first term.
100%.
President Trump said, I've seen proof of it where they have a vaccination. It looks like the size of a soda poured into a little child body, the size of a bottle of soda poured into a little child's body. Where is that proof?
Well, I suppose if you add up 94 vaccines, it's a lot of, it's a big volume.
And but a typical vaccine is like 0.5 milliliters.
Trump is concerned about that dramatic expansion of the vaccine schedule that happened in our country and not other countries.
The absolute most that children get in terms of vaccines between birth and till they're no, you know, 18, no longer children, is around like 70. So I guess theoretically you could say if you took 94 vaccines and you put them into one bottle, it would be in one bottle. But Donald Trump said he saw someone getting a vaccination the size of a soda bottle.
A baby. He said the size of a soda bottle being poured into a baby.
Poured into a baby.
And RFK Jr. is not just some rando. He's in charge of Health and Human Services. He's in charge of public health policy. And this guy is willing to embarrass himself in this way to protect dear leader.
I don't know if he feels embarrassment.
He may not, but I got news for you. He embarrassed himself. He may not feel it at all. I don't think he does. I don't think he has a consciousness. I don't know if he thinks that everybody's stupid who hears that, or if it just doesn't matter to him, or he's not capable of registering that other people have perception. But he embarrassed himself. I mean, just full on embarrassed himself. If he had literally walked across the carpet to lick Donald Trump's boots, I don't know if it would be more embarrassing than that. Because here he's actually making an effort, you know, to intellectually justify something. And on some level, for a guy like him, it's got to be a little bit more embarrassing. I read his poem to Olivia Nuzzi. I'm not so sure that the crawling across the floor and licking a boot would necessarily be as embarrassing to him as this. Right? I mean,
right.
I'm not kink shaming. I'm just saying. I'm making an assessment. All right. I think if you've seen me talk about Jubilee in other environments or in this one, you know that I have my misgivings about it. I went on there and I thought it had some utility in terms of like exposing just exactly what the Republican Party has turned into. But I also think the critiques of Jubilee and Surrounded are correct. Fortunately, they have finally put on a moderate, sort of a
fence sitter,
a Cheney, Liz Cheney, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I guess Rahm Emanuel, establishment moderate type guy. But he dresses like a skateboarder, which gives him a cool effect.
Like Hillary in a beanie.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine for a moment that Hillary Clinton was bald and wore a beanie and had facial hair. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Tim Pool shows up on Jubilee. Here he is. Which clip is this?
This is number 12 with Mason from One Hand to Politics.
Yeah, we've had Mason on. Maybe we'll have him on again for this.
For the Rubin one, was it, that we had him
yes.
on for?
Yes. I wonder if Mason's concerned that that there may be a warrant out for his arrest because he killed Tim Pool. Here he is. This is Tim Pool like claiming is that right wing violence is
less of a concern.
Less of a concern than left wing violence. Despite the fact that we have seen the DOJ make other claims and whatnot, but he's going to go on to pretend that, well, let's hear him.
I wouldn't describe Nick Fuentes as a neo-Nazi.
You don't think that Nick Fuentes celebrating Adolf Hitler is not neo-Nazi adjacent?
I think you have to be very specific on what your terms are. And so when you go to an American voter and say something like...
Is this clip number 12? Yeah.
This is our moderate.
Oh, I should just say, yeah, hold on. Go back a second. You will see Tim Pool hide behind. Well, what are your terms? Well, you tell us. Who constitutes a neo-Nazi if not a guy who praises Hitler, demonizes Jews? I mean, it's not like we're taking clips out of context. I mean, Fuentes has sat down with Piers Morgan and went deep into this stuff. And it's pretty clear what Fuentes' ideology is. He has given up on the Republican Party in a sort of like a tactical change at the moment. But the Heritage Foundation had an implosion, and Heritage Foundation is the primary driver. They the ones who came up with Project 2025. They are the primary intellectual driver of the Republican Party in this country. And the head of the Heritage Foundation defended Nick Fuentes, went to bat, almost tore down the organization to defend him. You know who else refused to criticize Nick Fuentes? Not Donald Trump, who had lunch with him. His vice president, J.D. Vance, who refused to criticize him. But here is Tim Pool pretending like, oh, Nick Fuentes, what are you talking about?
Them, which you've seen.
Can you tell
how
me
about
who
this?
Chris, let's tell me who Chris Ray is. Do you know who Chris Ray is?
Explain it to me.
Well, you have a show talking about politics every day. I would think that you know. But Chris Ray was former...
Let's not do this. If you have a point to make...
Oh, pause it. Hold on for a second. Well, I think there's a point there. This guy talks about conspiracy theories all the time. He was saying that he said there was reason to believe that the 2020 election was stolen. He had Laura Loomer on his podcast to talk about how they should be potentially killed for treason. Isn't that who Chris Ray is? I think there's a point embedded in that, whether Mason meant to make it or not, but okay.
Brian, yes, sir. Games. So Chris Ray was the former FBI director under Donald Trump's first term. Yep. He said that...
Now he knows. Yup.
Oh, that Chris Ray.
Oh, Chris Ray. Ray. Chris Ray.
With a W.
No, I'm sorry. I thought you said... I'm wearing my hat. So I thought you said Liz Ray. And I was like, Liz Ray, who's that? Don't do this to me. I'm going to do my podcast. Go ahead.
Findings from both the congressional research session that right-wing violence is way more proliferate in this country than left-wing violence.
That's not meaningful to a voter. Let me explain. The Republican Party rejects neo-Nazism, correct?
No. Donald Trump invited Nick Fuentes to have dinner with him, Kanye West.
So tell me one politician who went out and campaigned for the neo-Nazi vote.
Pause it. I'm blanking on his name, but Gozar.
Wait. Mason's going to give Gozar, he's going to go out and give explicit names, but I think when you call all Mexicans rapists, when you say Somalis are all stupid and dirty, when you actively promote racism in the country, you are campaigning for the neo-Nazi vote.
Can I just say, the original Nazis didn't campaign on we're the bad guys. They were like, we care about German families.
And hate Jews. You think, if you're hateful, vote for us is not the way that they go out.
Who's the guy who called himself David Duke without the baggage?
Steve Scalise.
The Republican number two in Congress.
Okay, besides him, though.
Okay, besides him.
Gozar and
is that a mainstream
Arizona
view in this country?
Well, we could talk about Gozar. We could talk about Matt Gaetz. We could talk about
Matt Gaetz is not endorsing neo-Nazism. And Donald Trump
said, "Are you kidding me?
Nazis should be condemned entirely."
No, he is literally partnering with the America First movement. He was
America First and neo-Nazism are totally different,
bro. So you don't think neo?
I mean, not historically or now.
Pause it for a second. Honestly, let's go into this just for a moment. Where was the original America First movement, Matt?
The original one? What do you mean? Like historically?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say around the 1930s, 1920s.
Yeah, and who promoted it?
Charles Lindbergh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Charles Lindbergh. I know about his plane work.
I think Tim Pool would call him an isolationist, but that isolationism crept kind of very often into admiration for the Nazi, what the Nazis were doing within Germany.
Wanted to keep the U.S. out of World War II. It featured Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh was a famous anti-Semite, and he was xenophobic and pro-fascistic.
Yeah. So, you can't argue historically that there's nothing to do with Nazism from the America First historically. Maybe Tim means contemporarily, whereas, the current proponents are, like you say, denying the Holocaust and saying Hitler was cool in the...
It depends on how you define your terms. It depends on how you define your terms. Go ahead.
Entirely.
No, he is literally partnering with the America First movement. He was
America First and neo-Nazism are totally different.
Bro, so you don't think do you think Nick Fuentes is a neo-Nazi? I forgot you've had him on your show. Oh my God, I literally forget.
I wouldn't describe Nick Fuentes as a neo-Nazi.
You don't think that celebrating Adolf Hitler is not neo-Nazi adjacent?
I think you have to be very specific on what your terms are. And so when you go to an American voter and say something like...
This is our moderate, by the way, everybody. This is our moderate.
Indeed.
Keep going.
So when you go to a regular American and ask them what is meaningful to them in terms of an election, you don't have Democrats or Republicans endorsing violence. But you also don't have... Charlie Kirk's a good example. He threw out Nick Fuentes. He threw out white identitarians, white nationalists from his events. They were not welcome. That's mainstream. You don't have riots coming from the Republican Party and the right, although you do have January 6th and things like that. When you take a look at the...
Hold on for one second. In other words, you don't have riots coming from the right, except for the riot that came from the right and actually stormed into the Capitol. I would also add that there is actually a right-wing force that exists in this country that promulgates violence. And too often we only blame violence on people who don't have weapons or don't have any power. But you look at what happened in Minnesota. You look at what's happening across the country at various times with ICE agents throwing a mace and tear gas into like kids, you know, like baby carriages and whatnot. They're right wing. There's your right wing violence. We don't call it a riot because when it's done by the cops, they're ostensibly doing it just simply to impose control over people. But it's a riot.
Also, this idea that he threw out the white identitarians, like, okay, he had a turf war with Nick Fuentes. He toward the end of his life was saying that MLK was rotten and that the civil rights movement was a mistake.
Yes, by the end of his life. Now, he started TPUSA because he thought at that era they needed to move towards like more social liberalism. I mean, Charlie Kirk, early on in TPUSA, used to travel around with a log cabin Republican. And I got news for you. By the end of his life, he was not traveling around with gay Republicans. That was a no-no. So he was capitulating. If anything, Charlie Kirk is actually an example of how the modern Republican Party has become to embrace neo-fascism, fascism, neo-Nazism, whatever you want to call that movement.
Neo-Confederacy.
Neo-Confederacy. Because he started out adamant that the Groypers were out on the outs. And the Groypers had a rivalry with Charlie Kirk. But by the end of his life, he was making space for these people. Candace Owens. The only problem with Hitler was that he was a little bit too ambitious internationally. Go ahead.
Tesla facilities, the X and things like that. When you take a look at the, say, the shootings of the Tesla facilities, the execution of Aaron Danielson, the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and one of the attempted assassinations on Donald Trump, not the Pennsylvania one, you can see the underlying ideologies overlap with the Democratic Party.
What?
When you take a look at like Nick Fuentes, he's opposed to the Republican Party. He's actively he's been endorsing Democrats right now.
He's been saying that the Republican Party is too left for him. It's not that he's opposed to the Republican Party in principle.
This is literally my point.
No,
Nick Fuentes comes out and says, do not vote for Trump. The mainstream Republican Party is at odds with these people.
No, again, if you're looking at all of the empirical data, the violence is way more on the right.
But
so
that's not
you can
claim.
Say what your feelings are. You
that's
can
not
say
my
that,
feeling nor the claim.
No,
it is not meaningful to a voter to say we don't like neo-Nazis and white supremacists because the Republican Party
say,
is not saying they
pause
want
it for a second. The claim is the mainstream left commits more violence than the mainstream right. That was his claim.
It's literally
wasn't
written
it?
On stream. I mean, he seems to be arguing a different claim, but right there on the screen, it's always said the mainstream left commits more violence than the mainstream right. So I don't know what claim he's...
Even when he's making this argument that supposedly the perpetrators of these crimes, and it's not clear to me that they are true, share more in common with the Democratic Party than the right-wingers who commit violence share with the Republican Party, it's absurd. It's absurd. The people marching in Charlottesville because they were mad about the Confederate statues that were erected in the 1920s at the height of the KKK in this country, where you had 6% of the population as card-carrying members of the KKK, which is basically the American version of Nazis, right? I mean, and they're just more localized. And Donald Trump was the one who championed those people.
Since 1977, records from the National Abortion Federation records at least 11 murders, 42 bombings, 200 arsons, and 531 assaults, and thousands of incidents of vandalism, death threats, and clinic invasions targeting U.S. abortion providers. I think that's pretty mainstream Republican.
Oh, my God. Of course, the anti-abortion violence. But also, let's be clear, this neo-Confederate right-wing neo-Nazis. I mean, the Republican Party, the Trump administration has renamed all of these camps after the Confederate generals.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Let's be objective of where the violence is coming from. And if it's more substantially coming from the right, that is a problem that needs to be tackled.
It's not coming from Charlie Kirk.
Okay, we're not talking about Charlie Kirk. We're talking about the overall ideologies.
In fact, we're not.
So you're telling
me, that's not my claim.
You're telling me that the prioritization of hierarchies, both ethnic, both cultural, that is not a dangerous ideology, but something like BLM that says, hey, maybe we should take back police violence. Maybe we should have accountability for people who are in charge of certain aspects of our nation. Committing violence on citizens, those are absolutely completely different ideologies. And the fact that you're saying it is more motivating for violence, that the left wing is encouraging people to take those that are committing violence accountable.
In the last 10 years, there have been over 465 incidents of left-motivated political violence that aligns with the Democratic Party. And
pause it for a second right there, because we don't need to listen to what the moderate is saying here. Tim Pool, they actually fact-checked. No credible standardized data set substantiates over 465 incidents of Democratic-aligned or mainstream left political violence in the past decade. In reference to this claim, party leadership repudiation cannot consistently be used to exclude right-wing violence while attributing all left-coded violence to Democrats.
He's playing a little No True Scotsman-style shell game where no one's truly a Republican. Nick Fuentes doesn't count for this because he's not mainstream, but he does say Charlie Kirk is mainstream. And as to encouraging violence, he agrees that Jan 6th was bad and violent. I'll just say Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA action sent 7 buses carrying 350 students to the Jan 6 rally.
Oh, okay, okay. One time.
Is that encouraging? The exact
one time.
One time of the exact time that you mentioned was bad. But
exactly. One time. All right, let's...
What would you even do? How would somebody kill for the mainstream Democrats or create violence? Like, who would be... They have no platform.
I mean, I guess the idea would be like, we're going to overthrow these hospitals or something.
Right.
To provide tax incentives to buy health insurance.
But what if somebody shot? What does he mean by shooting a Tesla facility?
Oh, there was vandalism at a Tesla.
Okay. Yeah, that's bad, but. But
you know the Democratic Party. You know their
Hakeem Jeffries.
The third plank on the Democratic Party is eliminate all Teslas.
Who's ever listened to Hakeem Jeffries and got so fired up?
You know how the Democrats have been agitating
Schumer
against
shoes.
Electric vehicles.
It wasn't in response to maybe a Nazi salute that the leader of Tulsa.
It could be the guy is dismantling our government. And I think Doge popularity is below 50%, which would suggest that it's not just democratically aligned people who are involved in that. All right, let's go to this other part where, look, You're going to hear on this Jubilee a lot of people accuse Tim Pool of being a grifter, of being performative, as of like having absolutely no real ideology other than one that makes himself money, that he's hiding his conservative leanings because he wants to be seen as a moderate, because that's where his money's made. And people are going to say he's performative, thin-skinned. He's just a big baby who doesn't want to be called out. And when he gets cornered, runs away. And to you, I would say, watch this and find out you're right.
The last time we talked about this was in 2019, so it's been quite a while. I think it was before that, actually. Calling for civil war.
I've never called for civil war.
Or not calling for, I'm sorry, said that we're on the brink of civil war.
And what was the citation I had for when I said that?
I would love you to
tell me. It was The Atlantic.
Okay.
And it was a journalist who interviewed several national security experts who said that there is a range of opinions in the national security space that the U.S. is trending towards a civil war. Notably, that when you cite people like Stephen Marsh, journalist, as well as Barbara F. Walter, former CIA, the U.S. academics describe the period that we're in as civil strife, meaning there's a criteria of death that has occurred for political reasons over the past year or years, for which the next phase would be civil war. However, towards it, I've not said that it will happen, although there have been many people who have said that we are in a cold civil war or some kind of cultural civil war. I always caveat because don't actually have a strong prediction.
First of all, you do have a strong prediction if you've been saying this since 2019. There's 42
articles about
people
it,
can
sure.
look this up. There's 42 of your titles that have the word civil war in it.
Correct.
Like big fonts on the front.
Sure pause
it
for
so
a
why
second.
Is that? So it's, wait a second. When do we know? Do we know when that Atlantic piece was written? Presumably it was written in 2019. And he's been talking about this one article he read for 7 years. He always pretends that he doesn't do this, but of course he does.
Just reporting the facts.
December of 2019.
Was the article?
Yeah.
And he's been talking about it for 7 years, the coming civil war.
It's the last thing he read.
Exactly. And I'm sure he, based upon my experience and what he admitted to me on our debate, I'm sure he read the first paragraph.
I know what he does read is the view count whenever he mentioned civil war in any headline.
All right, but go. He doesn't want to hear any more about this.
Sensationalist. It's easy to get clicks on that. There's a reason why you say it, because it's very profitable for your business.
Not necessarily. But there's we have 1,600 episodes of just IRL.
There comes a point where people stop taking your prediction seriously.
Are you going to make an argument, or are you mad at me?
I'm not mad at you.
Okay, then let's make an argument about whether or not we are tracking. No. If you're making an argument, you don't like my thumbnails, or
I'm saying that you say bullshit in order to get money. But
let me ask you a question. You can't answer.
I will agree with you that there's increased polarization. I would attribute a lot of that to people being specifically online.
Let me ask.
Less interaction with people that are in different camps.
Let me ask you a question.
You're going to sit here and tell me that we're way more polarized than fucking Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, who like shot each other with their disagreements. You're going to tell me that Andrew Jackson, who's the sitting president,
do you want to have a conversation, or are you just going to be angry?
Polarization?
Why was Aaron Danielson shot in the chest twice?
Sorry?
Why was Aaron Danielson shot in the chest twice?
I'm not disagreeing that political violence is taking place in question.
Answer the question. You say Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, but then when I ask you a question about an assassination, you defer.
You can say that there's a civil war every fucking year, and it doesn't happen.
I never said there was.
Pause it for a second. Let's talk about this. This is the second time he's brought up Aaron Danielson, who was a member, if not a supporter of, a supporter, if not a member of the group Patriot Prayer, which was a right-wing group, which is, I don't know if you could call it paramilitary per se, but they sort of like the Proud Boys-ish. I guess. I don't know what else to say.
But more religious.
Yes, but more religious. Goes in to basically have fights with left-wing figures. He was killed, allegedly, by a guy named Michael, I can't remember his last name, but from Portland. What is it? Reinhold.
Rhino.
And from Portland. And we say allegedly because he was, Reinhold was summarily executed by, I think it was like federal agents and a sheriff.
Yep.
They just shot him dead. Reinhold had admitted to killing Danielson. Said that he it was in self-defense, I think. So we don't really know what the circumstances of the killing was.
For someone who's a libertarian, you should probably be concerned at feds executing people in the street before they could have a trial.
Yep.
Happy news. I see I've had it all
Let
along.
Me ask you a
you
question.
You are the same thing as like the Christian rapture people who say that the rapture's coming every fucking year.
Are
and when it doesn't happen,
do you want
like,
a soapbox? Do you want me to get you a
I'm
soapbox?
Saying, it's really
I can
easy.
Leave. You want me to,
it's really
go?
Easy to like,
you
do what you do.
You
it's
leave?
Really easy to do what you do. Like, you literally just say, Civil War is happening next year. Civil War is happening next year. It's coming. Make sure you subscribe to TimCast. Continue to watch my videos, please. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. It's easy to do what you do, bro.
Oh wait, why did he come back?
No one has actually had a debate yet. Are we going to actually talk about whether it will or will not happen? I mean, sounds like it's gonna.
All right, if you like to be the next,
put a date on it.
Let's now do let's just randomly pick an area.
Maybe a Russian funded roulette.
Yes. Let's play Russian roulette with Tim Pool surrounded. We should I don't know, is there a way to get like a pick a random number or just I don't know, pick a just a random time code and we'll do this because nobody's watched it yet in the in the studio. So let's just pick a random moment and see what we get. Tim Pool. Now, incidentally, you should understand this. When you do this, the surrounded people ask you, how do you want to be identified? And they'll come up with something that they think is going to be a polarizing. I think they wanted to call it Tim Pool versus 20 progressives. Why do I think that? Because that's how they titled their YouTube channel or their the program. But I think Tim Pool wanted to brand it a moderate versus 20 progressives. And they allowed him to do that because that's the way that you know, otherwise he probably says, I won't do it. Because Tim Pool is back to attempting to be a moderate now. You'll recall this so-called moderate was mad at Candace Owens for inhibiting the electoral chances of the Republican Party. He is a Republican partisan with a right-wing belief system who couches it in occasionally just branding himself something that he's not. All right, let's just pick this random code.
It appears that they're talking about free speech here.
All right, just drop it in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. ...of speech, control of voting, or manipulation of voting for the power, for the, let's just call it control by a particular group of...
Oh, pause it for a second. We should just say the claim is the Democratic Party has embraced authoritarianism. Now, the question is, like, when did it embrace this authoritarianism? Is he talking during the Biden years?
I was going to say COVID.
COVID, yep.
So after the Trump administration had the most serious of lockdowns...
They were misled by the Democrats.
Oh, but the Democrats said you got to take the vaccine. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One at a time.
Yeah.
First, on suppression of speech.
Indeed.
Just a few hours ago today, Trump subpoenaed reporters for trying to report accurate information on the war in Iran.
Wow, that's terrible.
No, that can't happen.
Awful.
That's way more authoritarian than what we're seeing on the left here.
Well, I mean, it's hard to quantify what is more or less authoritarian, but certainly bad when President Trump is trying to stifle speech.
Is it really hard to quantify?
I don't know. When I see ICE shooting people,
I mean, if
head.
You say the Democratic Party has embraced authoritarianism, what does that mean? Like a tiny bit of authoritarianism? Like they are scheduling, they're putting South Carolina first in their primaries, and that's like they're dictating when the primary
or
is?
Or they ask the heads of social media companies to, like, hey, can you not do vaccine misinformation? And those tech companies are like, no, we're good. We're going to do a little bit of it. That's the authoritarianism that you put next to subpoenaing reporters.
It's both hard to quantify and qualify authoritarianism. It's just much better if I just say it.
What is more or less authoritarian, but certainly bad when President Trump is trying to stifle speech.
Wait, can you give example of Biden doing anything even comparable to that?
I can. We can start with Alex Berenson, who is currently in a lawsuit because the Biden administration personally went to social media platforms using his name to be suspended for his reporting on COVID vaccination and mandates.
Okay. At a top level, though.
Okay, let's be clear. The Biden administration did reach out to Twitter. Also, the Trump administration did, too, incidentally.
Also, the owner of Twitter is a part of the Trump administration.
Well, now. Yeah. In 2021, he wasn't.
No.
And but the idea that they're talking about COVID misinformation and Twitter then follows through. Some other media platforms didn't. This is not the banning of free speech. Now, if you want to nationalize Twitter, that's a good thing. But to say that there's nothing comparable that Trump did, I give you Jimmy Kimmel. I give you Stephen Colbert. I give you CNN as an issue in the Paramount thing. I give you CBS News. We could go on and on. Like, literally, his FCC chair listed out all of the people they've taken out of media. And this is direct action by government officials. Go ahead.
Who's doing the majority of the, like, actual suppression of speech here?
I don't really have good words for the Republican Party, to be honest. My issue with this debate is in fact,
pause
what we're
it.
Seeing right now is that...
Let's just read the fact check. He was reinstated after settling a separate lawsuit against Twitter in 2022. Berenson alleged that administration pressure violated the First Amendment, but a federal judge dismissed his case against Biden-era officials in 2025. That would be after the Twitter files. The Justice Department later settled the appeal in 2026 without a merits ruling that the administration acted unlawfully.
I'll say in other words,
they paid him off anyways.
Also, a Twitter ban is not a subpoena.
No.
Just I think you can maybe quantify these things in the sense that one is a subpoena and one is a Twitter ban.
Go ahead.
A claim about the Democratic Party, which has done awful things, and the immediate response is, but the Republicans. And I don't like Republicans.
Here's the thing. We live in a...
Pause it for a
system.
Second.
Correct.
Right.
You literally were chastising Candace Owens for undermining a Republican's midterm election prospects.
Right, just a lie.
That was like, what, 3 months ago? 5 months ago?
Part of the brand, though.
Yeah.
He's just a centrist. I do like that Jubilee couldn't even say a moderate versus 20 progressives.
Right. They had to
They're
put
like,
Tim Paul.
We have, to, we have we, an we, obligation to be honest.
We can have this great grift of like, the Democrats are bad, but we can, and the Republicans, they might be worse, but the Democrats are still bad. But the option is between Democrats or Republicans.
Yes.
So if Republicans are worse, it doesn't really matter if Democrats are slightly bad.
I think Democrats are worse.
We don't love Democrats. But we feel that Republicans are way worse when they institute these far more authoritarian policies.
It's hard to quantify more. The question is, does it suppress speech? And I certainly think Donald Trump has taken actions.
Let's look at human lives. If we want to do like a quantification here, let's look at ICE. Three American citizens have been killed by ICE. That's way more than the number of American citizens killed by immigration enforcement under, say, Obama.
But it's way less than the amount of American citizens killed by Barack Obama.
No.
It is true. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Look. I don't want to be disrespectful, but one of the biggest issues to me is the extrajudicial assassination of Abdulrahman al-Awlaki by the Obama administration. And this is what, early on in my life, when I was very anti-war, very lefty, still anti-war. And voted for Barack Obama, and then he murdered
us. Are you in favor of the war in Iran?
Absolutely not. And Barack Obama killed a 16-year-old American citizen who was at a civilian restaurant in Yemen.
We can play this game. These are all bad things. We can be like, oh, well, both parties are pretty bad. But, like, indeed, we have to, when they go to the ballot office, when I go to the ballot office as a voter, I have to actually put in a vote. I have to decide Democrat or Republican or throw my vote away and vote for some third party.
Libertarian.
If I'm picking between those and there's one candidate who just brought us into a war in Iran, is causing this massive conflict, tons of human suffering, that's foreign. That's foreign policy. Domestically, we see ICE attacks on American citizens. We see 56 people dying in ICE detention camps in just a singular year. You compare that to under Obama, the deporter in chief. Across 8 years, 52 people died. Way, way, way fewer. What we're seeing is dangerous conditions domestically. Way more people are dying. Right, we have a lot of this like qualitative discussion. You bring up a lot of anecdotes. But if you actually like quantify the number of deaths that are occurring through these authoritarian mechanisms, it's very, very clear that when I vote, I'm choosing the lesser of two evils and voting Democrat.
Let's talk about a few structures of authoritarianism. We'll go with 2016. And you brought up Donald Trump subpoenaing these journalists. So yeah. we'll get broad on this one. In 2016, Gizmodo published an article that Facebook had been suppressing news and information from conservative outlets. This is Gizmodo. They're a progressive outlet. In fact, I worked for the company that owned them, and I was a Bernie supporter in 2016. And so agreeing with this reporting and knowing the reporters behind it, I reported this. NBC News, all of these major institutions then claimed I was a right-wing conspiracy theorist.
Here's the thing.
Well, let me finish.
Oh, wow.
For claiming that these things happened, that they reported.
Pause it. Incidentally, the words government never even came out of his mouth, nor Democrats.
Yeah. But Facebook is like the Democrats.
Facebook is like the Democrats, and NBC News is like the Democrats. And somebody called me a right-wing a grifter. When did I go on that first time where he said the Thanos thing? That had to be... No, that was probably later than that, right? It was. And he was just telling me, like, he doesn't trust the polling, even if it comes from Fox News.
Joel Kaplan, who was a Facebook exec, who was also seated behind Brett Kavanaugh when he was going through his confirmation. Joel Kaplan is on record after this whole fact of basically lobbying to keep Facebook couldn't address hate. For instance, like rampant Islamophobia or misogyny, because it was their dragnet for the algorithm that was looking into those things kept flagging candidates for office from the Republican side of the ticket. They're actually gerrymandered in, grandfathered in to allow more stuff. So this is a long time ago. I don't really know. I don't remember this Gizmodo article. I'm looking through it. It doesn't look... Looks like there's a small group of conservatives. I don't want to dismiss it offhand, but I am leaning that way. Anyway, let's get back to Tim.
Then what we learned is that under Obama,
Tim, really...
under Obama and under Biden, and don't get me wrong, this was under Trump as well, there was an active effort from the FBI. They were given a backdoor access to Twitter and Facebook to remove content that they thought objectionable to the government, and it was not done at the behest of Trump or for his benefit, but to the benefit of those who had been defending him in the press. So notably myself, who was calling out these censorship practices, I was falsely slandered and maligned by the media over
this.
Thank
you. Yes.
These are institutions. Now, when you say that Donald Trump is mad at them, I agree, subpoenaing journalists depending on the issue
he's completely like the whole point is it has nothing to do with the Democratic Party. If he wants to tell me there's government overreach, that is a different story than the Democratic Party is responsible for that. This is his game. You can't quantify anything. You also barely can qualify anything. And any slight against him is indicative of authoritarianism, even if it comes from, I don't know, us.
That's the number one conservative thing, to come back with facts with an anecdote. That's how they've always argued, forever.
We will have more Tim Pool stuff in the coming days. We will delve into it. This Liz Cheney... Debbie Wasserman Schultz style moderate going up against progressives.
Wacky progressives.
Couple IMs and then we're out of here. Science is political. Why does Tim always say indeed? Does he think it makes him sound smart?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Indeed.
Indeed it does.
Wait till he starts saying indubitably.
Tom Cotton's beard. Did Tim refer to a civilian restaurant? Hama Spiker. Spiker. Sam, long time, first time. I finally bought a membership. Huge fan. Can you send Vivek, see you on the trail, to my wife and dog, Gia?
Oh, God. I don't know if I have see you on the trail.
You've got to have that.
It's been so long.
Dude, come on. Don't you have, like, a specific, like, file for this?
So we've changed computers.
A hilarious thing to get yelled at.
Changed computers.
The keeper of the soundboard. Come on.
I think I can find it in the file somewhere here.
Don't you just search it? How do you label it?
Oh, yeah, here.
So Fox and friends, join us on the trail. We'll have some fun. I'll see you out the trail.
Oh, my God. That is
out the trail?
Yeah, out the trail. It's hip to talk like that.
That was he was on a I'd just been rapping on Fox high, and so he was like, "We're gonna have some fun on the trail, so we'll see you on the trail." That's how he rhymed.
We'll have some fun. I'll see you out the trail.
The next governor of Ohio, folks.
June Oliver, I'll never forget when the moderate Tim Pool told you that rape victims have a responsibility to carry any resulting pregnancy to term if they don't go to the police to report their attacker. You got to go to the police to get a medallion that says you don't have to have the rapist baby.
The moderate position.
That's the moderate position. John from T-Berg, my biggest problem with Tim's surround was too many people besides Mason and the gentleman in the green shirt. Look at Tim at face value and didn't challenge him on pretending to be a moderate while presenting these broad, vague-ass claims to seem like a reasonable commentator, like that time Sam went on a show and kind of he agreed with him the whole time because Tim believes in nothing. Kind of emblematic of the entire problem with these videos as a concept.
He had that Dave Rubin energy, too, where he just seems so checked out. Like, he just doesn't want to be in this space anymore.
Why did I do this?
Aaron from Germany. Sam, do you know if your Zateo appearance will be behind a paywall? I haven't seen uploads on YouTube. I think eventually they put it on YouTube. I just don't know what their schedule is. Eric's Trump's plug. Did you see Jeffrey's back to clown show with not supporting Medicare for All and then coming out against Bill Zarian? Someone should probably tell him that he doesn't have to talk. He did explicitly say he's against Medicare for All. He also said he's for big court reform, though not explicit as to what that meant. That's very important because if we do get Medicare for All, we will not go forward with these courts. We know where he stands on Medicare for All. But, you know, at the end of the day, we don't need him. We need 200 committed Democrats in the House. And then he will fall in line. He will be primaried in 2 years. Stone Cold Stunner. The idea that we've run out of missiles is somewhere between pathetic and disturbing. The U.S. has never been more of a paper tiger. All right, three more.
I do want this moment. Like, people need to realize how much money we've been blowing into the military-industrial complex and not actually to build up a strong military.
Hack All Things says, those are all real apples, you uncultured swines. Ad Nauseam says a fresh McCoon is unbeatable. The Mill Ryan says the animus you have towards the jazz apple is disturbing.
Sam's making all these up.
Lost in the pawpaw sauce. Brian the Apple Boy sleeping on the job. All right, two more. Let's see. Miss Piggy, Matt, would you agree that today's guest statement that China has state capitalism after your interview on Left Reckoning last week? Or I guess what's the difference between state capitalism and market socialism?
I would defer to Helga on the specific taxonomy of how you describe China's economy. But nonetheless, it's true that the incorporation of like markets and entrepreneurship, but it's in China subservient to the state. Which is not here.
And the final IM of the day. Ryan from Santa Monica. So I never once thought the Cheney Bush Jr. non-democratically elected regime's war on terror was going to do anything except for steal resources, kill brown people, and take away the rights of citizens. Matt, Brian, Emma and Abstention, great job today. Folks, we will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bar. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah.